prices are just signals in the marketplace, and I was being sent a signal for what my service was worth according to the Medicare bureaucrats. And so I decided I needed to respond with a rational signal of my own. So I quit.
Welcome to Thinking on Lincoln, the podcast on 13th and Lincoln, talking about things on 23rd and Lincoln. I'm your host, Curtis Shelton, joined as always by my co-host, Ryan Haney, and our producer, Lindsay McSparren. Ryan, glad to see you again.
Yeah, it's good to be seen.
Yeah, that is. Got any Thanksgiving holiday plans coming up soon?
Yes. So I'll be going to, my parents have some property about an hour south of the city, but they own 25 acres.
A little Norman? Corn. Just kidding.
No, it's further out than Norman. But yeah, no, it's always a good time. My kids like to go out there, ride four-wheelers and fish.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
Shoot 22, so yeah.
That'd be fun. I'm trying to talk, me and my friends are trying to talk into another friend of mine who's got a cabin about an hour west of Enid that we've spent the last...
That's out there.
Yeah, it is. It's always, but it's so fun because we can, I mean, do the same thing. Just go mess around with no consequences for a couple of days.
Well, I wouldn't say no consequences, sure, but, you know, we try to keep it not too crazy.
Boring.
Yeah, I guess. Well, when you have three kids, you got to be boring.
So. That makes sense. Sorry. Not there yet.
Well, I am uber pumped about this episode.
Yeah, this is going to be good. I know people are going to enjoy this one.
Yeah, I think so. And for those who don't know... If you didn't see me hyping it up on Facebook, we had Dr. Keith Smith, anesthesiologist, founder of the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, founder of the Free Market Medical Association. Just an awesome dude. We had a great conversation, had more great conversation after we recorded it. He's just a really cool, smart guy.
Yeah, he really is. He's doing some great things and explains it in a very, very easy to understand way.
I love people who disrupt the system, and the best part about the way that he's disrupting the system is he's doing it outside of government. He's not at, like, and he said this on the podcast, right? Not asking anything from government other than to be left alone. And that's something that as I think about my own policy goals, where can I specifically, and then even OCPA more generally, like, what can we do to disrupt things that don't require us to go ask something of the legislature or to ask something of the governor? And I actually got a really good idea last week from somebody on one of those things. So,
yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a big aspect behind school choice, right? It's just, we're not saying get rid of these, like, you know, traditional public schools. We're just saying stop telling us where to go and let parents and students decide for themselves, like, what their best environment would be, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a certain aspect of that when we're asking for the money to follow the student.
That's true.
But at some level, it's like we're not defunding families.
Right.
Kind of the way I look at it. So, but yeah.
I like that. Nice.
With that, you want to just jump in the interview?
Yeah, let's enjoy Dr. Keith Smith.
Yeah, he's more fun to listen to than me.
Certainly.
All right. All right, so we're here today with Dr. Keith Smith from the Surgery Center of Oklahoma. Dr. Smith, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. So let's just, I kind of want to jump in, let you kind of introduce yourself. You are an anesthesiologist. And you've got a really compelling story. Why don't you just kind of tell us a little bit about how you got started in medicine and ended up founding the surgery center?
Okay. I think I've always been a fan of the golden rule and mutually beneficial exchange, and the practice of medicine, I think, fit that beautifully, where you really could give a service to someone and it would constantly feel mutually beneficial with almost instant gratification of that mission. So I think that's largely what drove me to medicine. Once I got into medical training, I was interested in the science part and also the invasive part of anesthesia. It's a real hands-on sort of a specialty. So got decided wanted to go out into practice and be in private practice and work for myself, and went up in Oklahoma City because it was a very kind of a wide open environment where a young right out of practice, if you were good at what you did, sort of doctor could be successful and not have to pay your dues for years, like is the case in many places in the country. Managed care had a very limited penetration here. And I wanted to do cardiac and pediatric anesthesia, and Oklahoma City needed that.
Okay. So, now, are you from Oklahoma City or the state?
I born in Tulsa and lived in Durant and Lawton and wound up in Oklahoma City going to school. So, yeah, I was basically Oklahoma.
So, did you start out your career in medicine? How did you start out your career in medicine? Did you immediately go work for yourself?
Yes, I immediately went into private practice in an anesthesia group, but, had to go to the bank and borrow, what I needed to live on until money started rolling in. Had to buy my own anesthesia machine. So I had some expense when I started up, but I was pretty confident that I was going to, going to be busy, and I got busy right away and did very, very well.
Okay. And so, obviously you didn't stay there. You eventually went and started the surgery center. So what, was there something that kind of you, where you became disillusioned with what you were doing?
Yeah. In, 1992, the federal government, decided, that they knew, and when I say federal government, I mean Medicare, that they knew what every service that any physician provided was worth. And so this was called the resource-based relative value scale that was adopted by Medicare. And I made about $1,100 for an open-heart surgery for the anesthesia services that I provided in 1992. After RBRVS round one, that was cut in half. And not satisfied. Of course, this all happened under a Republican administration. After that, not satisfied with RBRVS-1, they inflicted RBRVS-2, which cut that in half. So the last anesthetic I provided for an open-heart procedure, I was paid $285. It was about a six-hour procedure. The last anesthetic I provided for a knee replacement was on a Medicare beneficiary was about $78. So I'd read enough economics by then to know that this wasn't personal. Prices are just signals in the marketplace, and I was being sent a signal for what my service was worth according to the Medicare bureaucrats. And so I decided I needed to respond with a rational signal of my own. So I quit. And I didn't quit taking care of Medicare patients. I just quit filing claims. I didn't feel like it was appropriate to legitimize what I thought was illegitimate by filing claims. And I also, by that time, had come to my own philosophical position where I realized the government didn't have any money that it didn't first steal.
Right.
And so if I accepted government money, I was in possession of stolen property. So I decided right then and there, this was in early 1993, that I would never accept another dime of money from the government. All of this created such chaos and havoc within the medical community that there was a lot of fear, particularly among hospital-based physicians like anesthesiologists, radiologists, pathologists, emergency room doctors. And the hospitals emboldened by this fear, began to take advantage of physicians in general. A lot of physicians were scared and, wanted to know if they could sell their practice to a hospital. And so hospitals really began to gain the upper hand on the practice of medicine as a result, I believe, of the resource-based relative value scale, because it just scared the bejesus out of a lot of doctors. And they sold their practices or just begged for help. So the entire time, the hospitals very smartly initiated what I believe is a deliberate propaganda campaign that would lead everyone to think that they were financially struggling, that they were going broke. And you still hear this.
The hospitals.
The hospitals, yeah. So while many physicians were struggling because of these cuts, the hospitals were actually making more money than ever. But they had a very effective campaign to convince everyone otherwise. So, you know, the hospitals are going broke, and, you know, we knew that wasn't true because we could see the hospitals building on and buying physician practices. We could see, you know, every emergency room that was supposedly bankrupting these hospitals had a crane in front building on. And in the old days, we would go to the medical records department and you would open up the paper chart, and on the right side was all the clinical information, and on the left side was all the financial information. And so you could see firsthand the extent to which patients were being financially brutalized by these hospitals that were building on and claiming they're going broke the whole time, when in fact it was the physicians who were just getting skewered. So, you know, when you really thought about this, I mean, I was involved in the bankruptcy of these patients. So, I mean, I was an accomplice. I was an accessory to these crimes. But at the same time, seeing our income dwindle. And I didn't sign up for this. And I didn't want to be a financial serial killer. That just didn't make sense. So the only way that I could see to break this was to secede, was to basically get out. And I thought, if I can be in control of the patient's medical environment and also be in control of their financial environment, then they're going to be better off, I'm going to be better off, and the only losers are the price gougers who are really getting away with a heist. So that all of that really started boiling through my head in, you know, the early 90s, and that led to walking away and starting the surgery center.
And I want to get to that in a second, but there was something you mentioned that I had a question about.
Okay.
You had mentioned that it was essentially Medicare that was driving your fee down. Were they not also applying the same pressure to the hospitals?
Well, no, the hospitals were making just as much money, if not more money, than they had made before. So, I mean, at the time, there may have been a dip in what Medicare was paying the hospitals, but they more than made up for that for when what they billed the private insurance. What we saw as physicians was that the private insurers piled on, knowing that all they had to do was pay a little bit more than Medicare, and the physicians really didn't have anything to say. They couldn't fight because we were accepting, most physicians were accepting Medicare fees. I decided not to.
Right.
So, you know, all the big insurance companies piled on too. But the hospitals had and still have a system in place where they are paid based on their cost. And so they have these Medicare cost reports, and there are all kinds of ways to game that. And they also didn't pay tax.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. So Medicare was driving down what they were paying the physicians, and maybe doing some of that to the hospitals as well. But the hospitals were making up for that by getting that from private insurance. But the physicians were not able to do the same thing.
Not really, to a very limited extent. And that whole concept is called cost shifting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, to a very limited extent, doctors could get away with that, but not really, because, you know, that was the rise of the PPO machine, and so you had to sign these contracts which limited physician charges, and all of that stemmed from what was inflicted on us by the RBRVS.
Yeah, and that wouldn't have made you feel any better, right? I mean,
no.
By, you know, going after the insurance companies.
No, and, you know, and I, you know, full disclosure, I did that for a little bit. I mean, I charged insurance companies what I charged them, and I didn't charge Medicare patients at all. But it was just unstable. It was not just. It just seemed wrong. It seemed wrong to enable the hospitals to, you know, balance bill patients like they did. And so the only answer really was to get out. The other thing that was going on was, I think, in order to justify their go broke narrative, They also began limiting what surgeons had and what other physicians had in order to conduct their business and practice. So patients were quality-wise victimized by this narrative. So yeah, it was just gross. You know, it was time to get out and started looking for a way, and found a place that was near death, you know, a surgery center that was failing. And Dr. Steve Lonte and I were in a position on a hunting trip, basically, where we bought the Surgery Center of Oklahoma operations in 1997, just before it failed.
So if people were to ask you what the difference between how you operate the surgery center and the hospitals, what would be the biggest difference, you'd say, in what they'll find at your surgery center compared to the other places?
The biggest difference, I mean, there are two big differences. One's price and the other's quality. I would say quality, the difference is so stark. That probably is the biggest difference, is the quality of care that patients receive, the efficiency of the experience. Price-wise, there's a huge difference. The good news is we've been doing this long enough, the price gap is narrowing. So, you know, the big hospitals have had to respond to our pricing. And so while that difference is narrowing, I would say the quality gap is still very large.
Yeah, what do you think attributes to that quality gap? Is it the way that you run it? Is it more physician-focused, like you mentioned? The hospitals are kind of giving it to the physicians, whereas you're a little bit more catering to those physicians?
I think that the main reason there is a quality difference is the market. You know, we don't have an insurance contract. So we don't have patients in our waiting room because we're signed up with some plan. We have patients in our waiting room because they want to be there, because our reputation is what it is. And if we're not good at what we do, then we don't have anybody in our waiting room. If you're signed up for all these crazy plans and you're not any good, you're still gonna have a flow of patients that come in. So, you know, we don't do what we don't think we can do well. So there are some things that are classically done at outpatient surgery centers that we don't do because I don't have the staff for it, or I don't have the surgeon talent for it, or the surgeon talent already exists in town and there's no way that I could duplicate it. So the things that we don't think that we can do well, we just don't do. So we do what we're good at, and we do a lot now. There's 130 surgeons at our facility now, so it's very, very busy, and we do a lot of different types of operations. But the quality comes from being accountable to the buyer and to the patient.
So how did this thing start? Whenever the other doctor,
Steve Lantier.
Okay, so when you and Dr. Lantier by this sort of failing surgery center, what's it like when you start up? Because you're starting, you know, you're accustomed to this other hospital model that you're kind of fed up with. What's it like whenever you get this started?
Well, it was scary, but it was exciting. The surgeons all were people that we knew, and they knew what they needed to perform their cases, and they knew who the equipment reps were from whom we could buy whatever equipment we needed. So, you know, we just sat down with the surgeons and, you know, said, what do you need? And looked at what supplies were already present and decided what was lacking and called the medical equipment reps who were happy to help us. And we filled in the gaps. And that basically is how we've grown from day one. You know, we decided from the very beginning that we would never accept any money from the government, and we also would tell patients what they were going to owe us up front prior to the surgery. So that distinguished us immediately in the marketplace, and we found that we could charge a tiny fraction, usually a tenth or less, what the hospitals charged, and still be profitable.
Wow. And did it? I assume that word of mouth was probably the biggest factor in the growth.
It was word of mouth initially. patients would go to the surgeon, and the surgeon would bring their patients to the Surgery Center of Oklahoma. Oh. Most of them had insurance, but our complete all-in bundled price was many times less than their deductible if they used their insurance at a big hospital. So we were out of network. The insurance companies hated us then. They hate us now. And so most of our patients had insurance, but they had a better out-of-pocket experience at our place out of network than they did in network at one of the big hospitals because of the giant price difference.
Wow.
So that's changed. When I launched the website in 2009, patients came to the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, and then I assigned them a surgeon.
I see.
So it's very different now.
Okay, so you just brought up the website. Now, did you start Surgery Center in 94? Is that?
97.
97, okay. And then in 2009, you started a website, and that's important because your website has all the pricing for your procedures, right?
That's right. We got into trouble. We got into real financial trouble when the insurance commissioner in Oklahoma decided to allow insurance companies to stack deductibles. And this happened in about 2006. So a patient had no out-of-network benefit unless they had already met their in-network deductible.
Oh,
so
wow.
That wasn't allowed up until that point, but that put us out of financial reach for the majority of the patients that had hitherto come to see us. So we saw our waiting room empty. And that's when I decided, you know, we're cheaper, we're better. We knew that. There should have been a light around the block.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to launch a website in 2009 and put all the prices. They're all bundled, so it's all in cash prices, and launched that in 2009. And the Canadians started showing up. That was the first thing that happened.
So the country with socialized medicine is sending their folks down to Oklahoma City?
I tell people the single payer that Canadians realize they can rely on is themselves.
Oh, I like that. I like that. Yeah.
Obviously it's a single payer. Was it the wait times? Was it the cost that they could still get it cheaper here regardless? Or what was the main driver of that?
It was the wait times because, you know, it's free up there. It's just not available.
Right.
Or it's not available in some reasonable amount of time. The most common story then and now is a patient that needs a hysterectomy who's tired of being transfused. So they're tired of getting transfusions while they wait in line. And so they pay $8,000. That's our all-in bundled price for a laparoscopic assisted vaginal hysterectomy with an overnight stay that pays everything. And so for $8,000, they can end their nightmare and, you know, not have to wait in line anymore. And the typical wait in line for that, we've been told by patients in the last couple of months, is about 3 years. COVID's made it worse.
Right.
The system up there has no sort of margin at all. So what was already just a fragile, very dysfunctional, socialized government system is worse now.
So I'm curious about that. I used to hear Jonah Goldberg say that he felt like, I'm curious to see if you agree with this, that healthcare is kind of like a three-legged stool, and you can pick two legs. There's affordability, there's universality, and there is the quality, like the quality of the care. So, you know, I think wait lists would fall into that as well. So in Canada, presumably, you know, you've got, it's affordable because it's free and it's available to everybody, but the care is not good, so they end up coming to your place. Whereas in the United States, at least the narrative is we're sort of somewhere kind of in between. It's like, it could be affordable, but for many it's not. It's certainly not universal, but the quality of care is really good.
Yeah, and I'd tweak it a little bit. In Canada, the quality of care is actually very good. You can find it. It's just not available.
Right.
I mean, if you call 3 years from now available, then it's available. I don't call that available. I call that absent. So it doesn't even matter what the price is.
That's a good point.
In the United States, what we found in this free market movement is that the more the market is allowed to work, the higher quality goes and the lower prices tend to go. But that's true in every industry. If you actually have market competition, prices plummet and quality soars. And that's, we're already seeing that in this market movement here in the United States. So that it's very dynamic. I wouldn't call it a static situation, but it's dynamic. The higher the quality goes, typically the lower the prices go when the market is working and the more available it is.
Right. Well, and because you mentioned, I mean, even the folks that don't go to the surgery center have you to thank for the lower prices they're paying at the hospitals.
That's right. And you know, the other point I make is because when prices are high somewhere, that means there's not much competition going on. Like in Wisconsin, on any given week, we'll see 10 patients from Wisconsin, and there's just no competition up there. So the prices are very high. The prices are high because there's no competition. And when there's no competition, the quality tends to be awful too, because if you're going to get that business anyway, you don't have to be any good. So there's actually an inverse relationship between price and quality in this industry. And until there's a more functional marketplace that is dominating, I think we'll continue to see that.
Yeah, and you mentioned creating a better marketplace. Correct me if I'm wrong, but is it true that hospitals are supposed to be posting their prices now a little bit more similar to what you've been doing? And I feel like I've been reading that it hasn't been happening, or if it's been happening, it's been very, very slow. What's been keeping them from doing that?
Well, the hospitals don't want to post their prices. And, you know, the government can't get anything right. I'm opposed to mandates of all kinds. And mandating that hospitals post prices, I think, was a bad idea. Jay Kempton and I called it a bad idea from the very beginning. If you mandate that a hospital post prices, all that does is create opportunities for unscrupulous legislators, which is basically all of them, to sell exemptions. And basically that's what happened, because they had these fines for non-compliance and the hospitals just paid them. Hmm. Well, this new administration comes on board, and what do? They make the fines, you know, much, much larger. Well, that sounds great. You know, we're going to get everybody to comply now. Well, no, the little guys can't pay the fines and the big guys can. It was the big guys' idea to increase the fines. And so now you will see a consolidation of the marketplace where there are fewer hospitals because the little guys can't pay the fines. Mm. So, you know, government doesn't get anything right, and healthcare is far too important for them to be involved. The other problem we have is that price transparency has been redefined. And Jay Kempton called this. He said, if you mandate transparency, you'll just see it redefined. So now price transparency is, what is the patient's out of pocket? It's not how much is a tonsillectomy all in, how much, you know, is chemotherapy for, you know, whatever, how much is that all in? Now it's, what is the patient's out of pocket?
And how can they even tell you what your out of pocket is without knowing a bunch of information about, you know, whether you're insured and what kind of plan you have?
And so, exactly. So the whole idea of government mandating price transparency is a farce. I mean, it's a dead end. And it's frustrating because, you know, patients, if they don't know, then they're going to be brutalized afterwards.
Right. Now, tell us a little bit about, and I think this kind of dovetails into some of the, I think it'd be interesting to hear about some of the objections and hurdles you've gotten, both from government, you know, wanting to, not liking what you do, probably because they're very responsive to this hospital cartel, and then also insurance companies as well. You know, the things that both of those groups have done to try to basically shove you out of business.
Well, the good news is people aren't giving us trouble anymore. We seem to have pretty good support on both sides of the aisle, because all we've ever asked for is to be left alone. I mean, we don't accept money from the government, so all we've asked is just leave us alone.
That's all I ask for, and they don't do it.
Let the market work. I know. We asked for that for a long time. In our beginning days, they did not leave us alone. And I think it bears repeating that our Savior early on that spared us death from legislation was a Democrat. It was Fred Stanley. And he was a brave guy, and he stood up to his own party, but more importantly, he stood up to the crony Republicans back in the late 90s who, working with the Hospital Association insurance companies, wanted to shut us down. So Fred spared us from many, many attempts to hamstring or kill our operation. The Republicans stepped up, led by Todd Hyatt.
Oh, okay.
And Todd Hyatt, I think, turned the Republican Party to a more open to a free market position in this industry and not just kowtowing to the cartel. And that he changed everything. I give Fred Stanley and Todd Hyatt a lot of credit because they really did hear me. They really knew and believed we just wanted to be left alone. We didn't ask any favors. We didn't want anything except to be left alone. And thanks to those two, we have been left alone for the most part. There was an instance where the state health department was actually weaponized by the members on the board to come after us. And we fought that off. There was a law Fred Stanley crushed that we referred to as the 30% law, where the law said that 30% of your revenue had to come from Medicare, Medicaid, or uncompensated care, or otherwise you had to pay a penalty to the extent that you weren't in non-compliance. And that was directly leveled at us because we didn't accept any government money, which meant they would rifle through our books and impose a penalty of 30% of our gross, you know, and Fred Stanley made sure that never saw the light of day. But
and of course, the hospitals were fine with that because you do uncompensated care, right? But there's no way. If it's a percentage of revenue, how can uncompensated care be considered?
It seems
in
a bit of a
revenue oxymoron
right there. Yeah.
Well, that was a real key turning point because a normally very level-headed hospital administrator, angry at me in a public exchange, asked me what percentage of our revenue was uncompensated care. And that question haunted me because it made no sense. Because in this room, I think we would all agree, uncompensated care is care you deliver for which you are not compensated. Well, that's not what uncompensated care is.
Not to the hospitals.
No, uncompensated care is a revenue item.
They're compensated for their uncompensated care.
Correct. They are compensated. They are compensated to the extent that they claim that they were not compensated. And this is a kickback arrangement with Medicare called disproportionate share hospital payments. And, you know, they put in a bill for $100,000, they get paid $20,000, and what do you know? They lost $80,000. And so that $80,000 loss is uncompensated care.
Even though it didn't cost them $100,000.
Yeah, because it's the $20,000 they received, I mean, is formed by $100 for an aspirin. So.
Right.
So anyhow, that was a real turning point for us because we began to understand how the money flowed and how gross it was and why an insurance company wouldn't want to work with us and why the hospitals, you know, relied on this uncompensated care fiction.
Well, and it's interesting that you brought up that you were getting some backlash or maybe some pushback from Republicans because that's in some ways still the case. Without naming any names, I think you consulted on a bill that we helped run last year that essentially would have kept hospitals from taking someone to collections if they did not provide a good faith estimate to the patient up front. And so, you know, Caitlin Jasper right. Was working on that bill up at the Capitol. I think you consulted on that. And ironically enough, it was some Republicans who, you know, are really cozy with hospitals and, you know, the hospitals didn't like that. And so that bill didn't get passed in large part because it was Republicans getting in the way. So this is not necessarily a partisan issue.
No, it's not. Now, before we go any further, I actually want to give some positive remarks about the hospitals in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
When we began to achieve some national attention, patients reached out to me for help with procedures we could not perform in the outpatient environment. So I reached out to hospitals in the Oklahoma City area to see if they wanted to step up and help these patients who were willing to travel to Oklahoma from all corners, and they have. So I am now referring inpatient cases to hospitals that worked hard to put us out of business in the beginning days. So, you know, bygones are bygones, and they're, you know, we've kind of locked arms here in Oklahoma City for all of the shenanigans that went on. The hospitals in Oklahoma City really are leading the way nationally and are really are beginning to go down the path that I'm hoping all of the hospitals in the country follow. Now, some of the area hospitals are better than others. There are two in particular that are incredibly difficult to work with here in Oklahoma City. But I've got to give them credit, because when a patient needs a robotic prostatectomy, or they need, you know, some complicated cancer surgery, you know, there are people that I can call now, and we're getting pricing, and I put the bundles together, and I collect from the patient as if it's done at Surgery Center of Oklahoma, and I pay these hospitals, and I pay the surgeons and anesthesia staff there. So for all of the, you know, head banging that's going on, the positives of what's going on far outweigh all of the negative stuff, I believe.
Okay.
That's great. Yeah. Do you think that this trend is going to continue? Like, do you think there's any next steps that we can go to continue to kind of bring back markets to healthcare, at least in Oklahoma, or do you see it needed to be more of a national discussion?
I think there's not a state in the United States that is even close to Oklahoma in terms of a market-based health sort of environment. There's not even a close second. I think Montana is trying. There are some issues with, you know, they're mostly federal issues, though. You know, can a person use their health savings account to buy a direct primary care membership? There's some things like that that would be revolutionary. But even the last administration and the IRS can't seem to get together and get some of those things done. So it is... The focus has to be on, not on Washington, because they created this. This system's working exactly like Washington designed it, for the benefit of the cronies and not for the patients and the buyers. So Washington can't fix this except to rescind every single thing that they've done up to this point. They just need to... They need to allow the market to work and attempt to fix all the damage that they've done to the system.
I'm wondering if you have, without giving you sort of a directed question, if you could kind of tell us what you think about Medicaid expansion. And it's still fair. I mean, it's still really new as far as actually enrolling patients, and obviously, you're not. You may be caring for some of those patients who qualify, but you're not accepting those Medicaid dollars. So I'm just wondering if you have some thoughts that you'd like to share with us about Medicaid expansion.
Well, government doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't work in any sphere. It doesn't have any business doing anything at the state or the local or the federal level, in my opinion. The prices we have listed online, to answer your question, are half what Medicare pays the hospitals for the same service.
Wow.
The prices we have listed online are less than what Medicaid pays the hospitals for the same service. I didn't create that pricing with a gun to my head. We did that de novo. We decided, what do we think is fair, and here it is. And amazingly, we came up with pricing that is less than what Medicaid is going to pay these hospitals for the same services. So the idea of expanding a program that grossly overpays for the services rendered and also does it at gunpoint. I mean, really, you know, there are physicians in the state who are in areas that are heavily populated by Medicaid patients. And if they're not signed up for Medicaid, they really have a hard time getting by. And so their only option is to move. So the real victims of Medicaid expansion are the poor, because they can be signed up for Medicaid and have all these services basically at no out-of-pocket to them. And it's going to feel a bit like a Canadian. There may or may not be that service there for them. So the whole idea of rationing, I think we have to be honest. You know, there will never be enough resources to satisfy demand in any industry, healthcare included. There's always going to be a situation where demand is larger than the supply. So you have to decide, how do we allocate these resources? Well, the free market is the most efficient, beautiful concept, you know, ever imagined to solve that problem. If you reject that, then you are throwing it into the realm of the bureaucrat. And that's Canada. It's where there is some bureaucrat that decides that hysterectomies are more important than knee replacements, or hip replacements are more important than cancer surgeries on people older than 65. So you have to decide. And if you have price controls like you have with government healthcare, like you'll have with Medicaid and its expansion, then you're going to create shortages. And the people that are really going to get shorted and victimized by Medicaid expansion are the very people who need affordable, high-quality care in the first place.
Right, and with Medicaid paying more than what you charge at the surgery center, and signing up these doctors with the contracts, again, that goes back to what we talked about a while ago, right? With the care going down because they don't have to be competitive, they don't have to raise the quality of their care to compete with you. They're going to get that business no matter what, and Medicaid's paying them more than what you're billing for that same procedure. So there's no reason for the quality of care to increase.
No, and then there's what is not seen. You know, what would have been done with the money that was wasted, that was extracted from the taxpayer base and, you know, flushed down the waste commode? You know, what would have been done with that money? So it's stifling of growth. It's stifling of everything. And again, government gets involved. If government shouldn't be in this industry, then government expanding should definitely not be on the table for discussion.
Right. Yeah. Do you want to talk about, I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about the Free Market Medical Association, a group that you started, what it does, kind of what the future looks like for that organization, why you started.
Okay, yeah. Well, the Free Market Medical Association was Jay Kempton's brainchild. He asked me at one point what I thought about doing it. He thought it might be a good idea. He was helping his competitors figure out how methodologically to deal with people like me, because they were buyers and I was a seller. You know, how does a buyer deal with a radical seller who will say, here's what I do and here's how much it is, and I'm not going to fill out all the forms, I'm going to send you an invoice. That's not typically how this industry works. So he was working with his competitors to assist them in how to accommodate what I wanted, which was basically smells like and looks and feels like a cash deal. I was assisting my competitors to how they needed to construct bundles and deal with the Jay Kemptons of the world. So we sort of had this umbrella.
And Jay works in the insurance.
Yeah, Jay runs a third-party administrator. So a self-funded client, which is a company that pays for their employees' health needs out of operational revenue rather than throw the money at Blue, United, Cigna, Aetna, and let them take risk. The company actually takes the risk. So most companies that have 100 employees or more are self-funded, and if they're not, they should be.
How many employees?
100 or more. Almost without exception, a company that has 100 or more employees should be self-funded.
Really?
There may be exceptions to that, but probably not. So you name all the big name companies in Oklahoma City, they're self-funded.
I knew Chesapeake was. That was the only one that
you could go way down the list, and yeah, I mean, Surgery Center of Oklahoma is self-funded.
Okay.
I have 29 employees, and I'm self-funded. So I pay the medical bills of the staff who work for me. But I don't have the checkbook. Jay Kempton has the checkbook. So Jay Kempton, before he pays for one of my employees' medical bills, he makes sure that they actually are employed by me. He makes sure that it is a medical need, not a cosmetic need. You know, things like that. So anyhow, if you're self-funded, then you basically are assuming the risk for the health needs of your employees. Well, Jay runs a third-party administrator that has many, many clients that are self-funded. And he wanted to buy from me at the prices I had listed online. And I said, that's fine as long as, you know, it's not laden with hassles. So he was teaching his competitors how to buy from me, and I was teaching my competitors how to sell to buyers like that.
Mm.
So Jay said, let's have start an association and have a meeting, and if 75 people show up, we'll have it again. And if less than 75 show up, we'll just, you know, say it was a bad idea. So we had it at the Skirvin the first year, and I think there were 115 people there, and they came from all over the country. And that organization has grown. I think we're in our seventh year now. Steve Forbes was keynote last year, big event in Plano, and he waived his honorarium. He told me it's the most important thing happening in the United States. 'Cause if you fix the waste in this industry, you've added 30% to the GDP. So it's a big deal.
Yeah.
Ron Paul was our keynote at the meeting before that. I think there are 32 state chapters now of the Free Market Medical Association. There are lots of people involved, think tanks. OCPA has had a great presence there. There are stop-loss carriers, third-party administrators, facilities, hospitals, imaging centers, physicians. I mean, people in all walks of the industry are there. So it's a very exciting association. It kind of has a life of its own now. I'll get an email that says, you know, the state chapter of, you know, whatever state you want to name is having their annual meeting or their quarterly meeting. And so it's really vibrant and exciting.
So if you've got 32 state chapters, why is it that Oklahoma is so far above what everybody else is doing in the sphere of, you know, utilizing the free market in healthcare?
I think that because we were first, the innovations here are, they're just ahead. I mean, every time, and I tell our staff this, every time we make a change for the better, we are that much farther ahead of everybody else who's, you know, trying to catch up and is in our wake. I think that Texas is going to give us a run for our money. The buyers, the self-funded buyers, I think in Texas are more motivated than the self-funded buyers in Oklahoma, which puts us at a disadvantage. The three biggest companies in Oklahoma, private companies, are not buyers from the free market. And I mean, they have a very effective broker, and so they're not involved. Some of the biggest companies in Texas are buying. And so, you know, that demand will drive the supply. And right now, Oklahoma is kicking Texas' rear end. But that could change.
Are they sending their patients up to you?
So yes. So the supply of sellers, providers like me in Texas is more limited. So there are a lot of companies in Texas that are sending their employees to Oklahoma to have their surgery done. That will change eventually, because the supply of people who are going to present themselves to prevent that attrition from happening is going to grow. And it's growing now, and it's to be celebrated. It's a beautiful thing. It's the market at work. But I think that the buyers in Oklahoma hopefully will become more aggressive and more involved and not be so afraid of all of the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that their broker, has put on the table to just scare them to death out of doing this.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like things are pretty optimistic in your mind about where healthcare is heading, it's, at least in the state, it seems like. Do you think there's anything that's holding it back from continuing this trend? Is there a way to kind of help those buyers, like you said, that might be a little bit scared to kind of enter into this free market field?
Yeah, and that's a great point. I've never been more optimistic about the free market and about affordability and high quality in care as I am now. We're on the brink, really on the cusp of this movement really taking over the industry and taking down the big price gouging giants. And it's very exciting, and I think I'll see it in my career, in my lifetime for sure. What is holding things back are the big self-funded buyers who are not involved. That's the big gorilla in the industry, the buyer, the big self-funded buyer. When they step up and they decide that they are going to take control of their health plan and buy directly and cut out the intermediaries that are skimming and robbing them, frankly, then everyone will have to fall into line, because they have such buying power that they can't be ignored. The state of Oklahoma, Health Choice, did this for a while. I mean, the largest self-funded plans in the United States are the state plans. But again, politics got involved and hospitals got involved, and that entire program basically went away.
Yeah, when you had your contract with the state, weren't the cost savings somewhere around $200 million a year?
Jonathan estimated the savings the first year, if fully implemented and embraced, would be about $200 million. But there were many, many efforts to hamstring the program early on, the results of which were used to justify not continuing the program. So politically, they couldn't just get rid of the program, so they just made everyone an offer they knew they would refuse. So, they told me they needed a 20 or 30% haircut off all of our fees or we couldn't continue with this. And so we fired them. And it was a big deal because, there was a fair amount of business and there were a lot of teachers and other state employees that, received the care that their deductible otherwise would have prevented them from having access to. So it was terrible what they did, but they crushed it because, the flow of patients away from the big hospitals was a big deal. And the hospitals probably threatened them that if this continues, they were just going to raise our rates on all the inpatient stuff. So, once again, government can't get anything right. They can't even get saving $200 million right. So,
right.
I should have known better than to do business even with the state.
Well, but correct me if I'm wrong, but you do have a good contract and a good business model with, I think, is it Oklahoma County?
Yeah. Let me be clear. I'm a fan of subsidiarity. So the closer government is to you, the less awful it can be.
Sure.
But there is a benefits director at Oklahoma County who is a fearless individual, and I don't know if he wants me to name him or not, but I'll just leave it at that. But he's been under intense pressure ever since Oklahoma County started their relationship with us to end it. And he has stood firm and stood up to that. And I think the first year that we were in our arrangement with Oklahoma County, and to be clear, what that means is Oklahoma County pays all the bills and the employees have no out-of-pocket expense. So it's paid at 100% and the county buys at a rate that I have listed online that's a great rate for the county, but the employee has no out-of-pocket expense. So, you know, the folks that work for county are not, by and large, people you and I would describe as highly compensated individuals.
Right.
And so their deductible is actually a real serious barrier to obtaining care. So, you know, at Christmas time, you know, we would have families tell us, you know, we were going to choose between our child having a tonsillectomy or having Christmas. And thanks to this program, we didn't have to choose. So it was very, very cool. We hear stuff like that all the time. But waiving the out-of-pocket was a big deal, and it allowed for people to access care that they otherwise couldn't afford. The first year we operated, the Oklahoma County saved about $3 million, and the out-of-pocket expense saved the employees was about $750,000. That was the first year.
Wow.
Now, there was a lot of pent-up demand because people were coming out of the woodwork because now they didn't have to meet their deductible to get what they needed.
They had been not seeking care that they knew they needed because
yes.
they couldn't afford it.
And the Oklahoma County still saved money. So Oklahoma County waived all the out-of-pocket, and at the end of the day, they still saved money. Bank First had the same experience. They were warned that if they went down this road, that utilization would go through the roof. And utilization did go through the roof because they took the deductibles away and people could get what they needed. And at the end of the year, they still saved over $1 million.
Wow.
So, you know, it's Oklahoma County has 1,100 employees, and the savings numbers from Oklahoma County, I believe, are what Jonathan Small used to extrapolate what the state of Oklahoma would have saved with 178,000 lives. So that, yeah, that's how you get to the $200 million figure, and it's not. That's not crazy math. I mean, that's real money.
Right, because once the utilization levels off, the savings, I would assume, also sort of take off as...
That's correct. Yeah, so you have all this pent-up demand, and once you take care of those folks, you know, if you still save money doing that, then yes, the savings the next year is just remarkable.
Yeah, that really can be so transformative, too, because not only are you talking about huge savings, but it's people now getting care they otherwise might not have been getting. So you're seeing better health outcomes, maybe less care later on in life because they've figured out some things earlier, as well as actual financial savings as well.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about the money all day long, but you're right. Lives are transformed. You know, a child that can't sleep at night because their tonsils are obstructing their airway, and you know they do better in school. They just feel better. Those lives are transformed. They sure are.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and before we let you go, I want to give you the opportunity to talk about some of the uncompensated care that you do at the surgery center, because you know Curtis and I we're with you 100% on voluntary exchange. But there are certain people that just frankly don't really have much or anything to exchange with you. So tell us a little about what you do for those folks.
Well, when a surgeon calls me and says someone's in my office and they don't really have much, but they really need they need their gallbladder taken out. And so I say, well, what are you going to charge them? And the surgeon says, I don't think I'm going to charge them at all. Well, as an anesthesiologist, I always match the surgeon's offer. So I don't charge them. So we're donating our physician services at this point. The Surgery Center of Oklahoma has real supply costs. So at that point, I wonder, well, can they actually pay the cost of the supplies? And I'm here to tell you, the cost of the supplies is not that large for the vast majority of surgeries. It's just not that big.
At least not for you. The hospitals will say that theirs
well,
are.
Yeah. We don't mark
We're talking about actual costs.
Yeah, I mean, like when we use implants, we don't mark those up. That's a pass-through. Why should I make money on implants? It's crazy. But
right.
That's radical. I mean, most people multiply that by 3 to 5. So what we found is, you know, somebody will say, well, yeah, I can afford the $450 of supplies necessary to do this case. And so we might collect that from them. So if my price for a removal of a gallbladder is $5,500, that pays everyone, and that's our number, after our number is 5865, and the person pays the cost of the supplies at $500, I would argue, we have given away $5,300 of care.
Certainly.
I would say that is care for which we've not been compensated, because all those numbers are real. But that's, in my mind, how it should be calculated. We had a lady from California who was an ultrasound tech and worked at a hospital, and she had a defibrillator implanted, and the battery ran out, and it started beeping, and so she needed her battery changed. So she went to the hospital where she worked, and they said, well, yeah, we can do that, and it's not covered, so we'll make you a deal. It'd be $180,000. Well, she had a relative who had heard about us, and we had never done a defibrillator battery power pack change, but they reached out and said, can you help us? And I called a cardiac surgeon who's a friend and said, can we do this? And he said, oh my God, that's a 20-minute procedure. That's easy. And I said, well, who's the rep we buy the battery from? So we got him on the horn, and I think the battery was $11,000. So, you know, 20-minute case, $11,000. I told her we'd do it for $2,000 plus the cost of the battery. And so she went to her five siblings, and they all gathered up what they could, and they paid for the battery and $2,000, and we did this whole thing for $13,000. And so when she came to the surgery center, she said she had decided that she was going to rob a bank if we didn't help her.
Oh, my word.
Because she would either get the money and be able to pay for this at the hospital, or she would be incarcerated where they would be required to replace her battery. Because, I mean, her battery was beeping and she really needed this. So, you know, did we provide is there some care we provided for which we were not compensated? I mean, we don't really look at it like that. We just think, well, on an individual basis, what do we need in order for this to feel mutually beneficial? And in a case where somebody really is in need, I mean, there's benefit to us to help that person out. I mean, that's compensation of a sort. So, I mean, we do this on an individual basis every day. That's what practicing medicine was like before the government messed it all up.
I love that. Well, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah.
This was
thanks for having
really
me.
Really great. Really appreciate it. Yeah,
my pleasure.
All right.